Okay, Mr. Briggs. So we'll start with the Grower Shipper Association, and that's part of this first group?
Yeah, I've got a group of cards here. Do you want me to read those off?
Go ahead.
And
is this the first?
Is this? So I'm assuming this is part of the 45-minute.
Yes, it is.
So we have Abby Taylor Silva, Danny Merkley, Bob Martin.
I'm Bob Martin. I'll be first.
Okay.
And Mark Los Huertos and Brad Barbeau. Is that all of them?
Not sure.
Brad Separate.
Oh, Brad Separate?
I don't need. What's that?
Okay.
I'm not going to watch
okay.
TV. Oh.
All right.
No, that's for Mark later. Okay, am I ready?
Okay. Yes, you are.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Young, and the board members for allowing me to speak today. I truly appreciate it, and Ag appreciates the opportunity to be here in front of you. And Chairman Young, you kind of hit the nail on the head right there when you asked the question to poor Alec. Alec is not really up to speed enough to answer some of those questions, but you asked him about the tier approach and the difference between the 2004 waiver and what it is now, and you kind of thought that it wasn't much different. Believe me, the devil's in the detail. And when Russ Jeffries asked the question about the tiering, that's just barely touched the surface about the difference in the tiers and how it affects the larger growers who are basically normally the most aggressive ones when it comes to improving water quality. So I just wanted to preface my statement with that comment right there. My name is Bob Martin. I'm a farmer, a board member of Preservation, Inc., and I've dedicated my career to taking care of the land, making it as productive as possible, and embracing new technologies. I have been active in water quality discussions since 1990s and was active in the formation of the 2004 Ag Waiver. I also served with a group of growers to form and oversee Preservation, Inc., while also personally working on water quality improvement goals on our farms and encouraging fellow growers to do so also. When we began seeing surface water quality data from Preservation, Inc., we better understood the significant need for water quality improvement, especially when compared to other watersheds in other areas. This was an important eye-opening moment for growers and drives our efforts to find water quality solutions today. Many growers changed their growing practices due to this data. I am here today because I care about water quality, and I care about regulation, how regulation will affect our business. As an industry, we understand you are tasked with the huge challenge of regulating the complexities of non-point source pollution. I would like to make a few suggestions before introducing my colleague, Dr. Mark Los Huertos. Number one, the board needs to repair and improve relations with growers. The Ag Waiver adoption process in 2004 was filled with compromise and synergy. We understand that as we learned more, the process would change, but the quickness of that change when it occurred in 2008 and 2009 caught the ag community completely off guard. Growers found themselves engaging with a new team of staff members with a different set of priorities. Despite robust conversations at facilitated meetings in 2009, we felt that staff had changed the approach, which no longer incorporated the ideas that agriculture, the conservation, and environmental communities had come up with together. Unfortunately, agriculture wasn't allowed to discuss, negotiate, or communicate with board any longer. Our efforts, as well as respected scientific concerns about the staff approach, have been berated. The loss of that synergy and collaboration was a major blow to me and my colleagues. In my office, I have a row of resolutions, awards, and proclamations. One that I'm extremely proud of is the one that was given to me by the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary for my work with their board. Collaboration has always been a priority to me. Unfortunately, in my view, it appears that it hasn't seemed to be a top priority with the staff and regional board in recent years, and that's led to a fractured, broken process. With three board members here tonight, I would welcome a restart to a collaborative relationship as we continue the process of addressing non-point source pollution. We've continued to try to find ways to update our program to address concerns by board members and staff. If you can convince the staff to work with agriculture, not to pilot the ship unilaterally, but really work together and to find solutions, that would make all the difference. If that's not the board's desire, all else is fruitless. Number two, let's focus on solving the problem, making the most efficient use of our resources. For every regulation you make, I encourage you to ask yourself, does this help solve water quality? Does it use money efficiently? Last year, our company has invested significantly in reducing our impact on the environment. We hired a sustainable agriculture manager. She carries a master's in environmental science and management with a focus on water resources and has experience working for environmental NGOs, state, federal governments. With this addition, our company has been able to analyze resources more efficiently, effectively, and target areas for improvement. In addition, in the last year, our company has spent almost $20,000 on soil moisture sensors and inline water meters to better gauge how much water I need for my crops while keeping fertilizers within the root zone. I know my efforts reduce or halted any negative contribution I may have otherwise made to groundwater. In the past decade, we and many other growers have invested in other practices such as drip irrigation. We have learned from reputable local experts such as Tim Hartz, Michael Kahn, and Richard Smith on how science and our technologies to improve our water and nutrient management such as quick nitrate tests and mobile irrigation labs. I also have examples because if I had to spend the $100 to $600 annually per acre, according to Dr. Barbo and Ken Mercer's economic analysis of the staff alternative for Tier 3 growers, that investment would never have occurred. A lot of this money would go towards paperwork and reporting rather than investing in these useful technologies. Through regulation, we have the power to encourage the use of these useful tools that allow growers to change their practices today and improve water quality today. Let's focus our money and time on partners we trust and technology we know that works. Three, let's make regulations that are enforceable. Today, to actually solve the water quality problems, we understand that all must participate and growers must be held accountable for their practices. Over the last couple of years, we've done what you've asked of us. You wanted to see more robust farm plans. We did it. You wanted a groundwater component. We did it. The board felt that agriculture shielded those who didn't participate in Preservation Inc.'s program. In fact, one of my personal complaints about the Preservation Inc. process, and I might get in trouble with some of my fellow growers here, is that there was not consistent regulatory enforcement by the regional board staff. Too many slipped between the cracks. We agree that your enforcement mechanisms weren't adequate and added a provision into our proposal that it reported growers not in good standing. The agricultural industry wants clear, consistent, and enforceable regulations. I doubt anyone here tonight hopes that in 5 years we're stuck in a courtroom debating the enforceability of regulations while water quality worsens. Again, let's not waste our money and time. Farmers for Water Quality, a group of grower groups predominantly representing oil crops, presented a coalition concept to you titled Attachment B in March and May of last year. In June, we began working with Dr. Mark Huertos of CSUMB to take this concept and help us understand how it could work on the ground. Mark is a well-respected scientist, has lived in the community for decades, and is actively engaged in teaching the next generation about soil science and sustainable farming practices. Today, he will re-present Attachment B, sharing details about how it could be implemented in local fields and how this approach is protective of water quality, which is our ultimate concern. We believe the coalition detailed in Attachment B would be an option used by row crops and any industry that thinks this type of coalition will be of help to them, consistent with your staff option, allowing for coalition-based approaches. I hope you'll listen with care today to Mark's presentation. Remember the three aspects or legs of the sustainable stool: social, environmental, and economic values. We can't accomplish the first two if the third option is taken away by expensive and onerous paperwork that may not accomplish our stated goals of improving water quality. Thank you, and I'll take any brief questions before I introduce Mark.
You have any questions? Martin, can you elaborate a little bit about the dialogue and the breakdown between agriculture and the staff?
Well, I don't want to elaborate too much because I don't want to create a lot of problems here with people. But I felt that the ag community, the environmental community, and water conservation community met without staff for three meetings in a row, and because staff was on furlough or something was going on, I can't remember. The staff they couldn't meet with us for three meetings, so we had our own meetings without staff. We pretty much came up with an idea that could be promoted at our next joint meeting with staff. And when we got there, basically they said, no, we're not going to listen to that. This is what we want to do. And they really didn't want to listen to our approach. That is when I basically slammed the lid of my computer and said, this is it. I'm sorry, but I can't put my name on something that I'm not going to let my fellow growers down. I don't want to be attached, have my name attached to something that I didn't have any support of or any part of. And I felt that my agriculture was getting thrown down the drain at that point.
Thank you.
All right. Mark?
My name is Mark Los Fuertos. I'm a faculty member at CSUMB, and I'm not going to present anything new. I've been working on vegetative buffer strips for my dissertation at UC Santa Cruz in 1992 and looked at nitrogen dynamics of those buffer strips. I've been involved in non-point source pollution best management practice research since finishing my dissertation. A lot of the funding coming from the regional board and state board. I have a current project where Karen Worcester, a staff member, is my contract manager looking at periphyton, which is algae that grows on rocks. When you slip on a stream, it's because the rocks are slippery because of periphyton, algae growing on the rocks, to use them as an indicator for excess nutrients, especially for phosphorus and nitrogen. Those have been generally limited to the drinking water standard, and it's been hard to come up with a more reasonable, probably ecologically relevant standard. And so we've been using an algal taxa to determine those more appropriate scientific concentrations. And the reason I bring this up is generally when I talk to growers that the drinking water standard is probably way high compared to what's beneficial use for aquatic habitat for nutrients, and they still invite me to the room to help them work on the ag waiver, I think that's saying quite a bit of how much they're willing to participate, even in spite of my work with the board and the perceived perception that I'm helping the regulatory process. I want to read something that Brian Dowd wrote in 2008 that I'm actually a co-author, but most of the good ideas were not mine. All the good ideas were not mine. He said, due to the nature of the processes of potential for limited reductions of pollution loading, a relative meager enforcement action in a regional board could appear captured by the farming industry were it not for the support of environmental groups lent to the process and its and overcame. This is reflecting on the 2004 waiver. Indeed, in spite of the long-standing tensions between growers and environmentalists, their respective organizations co-negotiated the waiver. Both sides cited the disadvantage, burdens, or weaknesses of the waiver, in short, mutually suboptimal result. Thus, the agriculture discharge waiver should perhaps be viewed as one step in a long process to develop, improve, evaluate policy tools to address non-point source pollution. Results from future monitoring may indicate that the water quality has not improved. If so, the regional board will be under pressure to scrap the waiver and change it dramatically, possibly invoking tougher regulations that will shatter the delicate agreement reached between all parties. I was actually surprised how accurate that was. So I think that well characterizes the place where I entered the conversation. The agricultural community had brought in a number of people over the years discussing the agronomic assumptions of the staff reports, sometimes in questioning them strongly. I'm not going to actually spend time with that because I think it derails the process. I'm more interested in coming up with a solution dealing with water quality improvements, and I don't want to spend a lot of time criticizing the staff report, which actually I think has a lot of merit in a certain context. I think I generally have convinced the growers that the problem is substantial. They all understand that. They all also understand that there are multiple policy options. And I think, bottom line, the way that I'm approaching the issue is that I'm trying to address it using a different policy option. And I have been on the sidelines until last March when I heard the agricultural community present a possible coalition approach, and I figured that that might have some merit. And then in May when they presented again, I thought there is something that seems reasonable, but they missed some key aspects. So I went to them in June and I said, you know, I think you could develop this into something worthwhile. They actually commissioned me, which was very sweet of them, to develop some more details on their proposal. So I guess I'm supposed to use these, huh? How do I do this, Lisa? Yep, got it. The original submissions were in March and May. You know what, Abby, can you help me with timing? Can you throw something at me? Okay, thanks. Originally submitted in March and May 2011. It was a logical outgrowth of a December 2011 proposal. I actually don't want to spend a lot of time on the details on that because I will admit I think that some of those proposals were a little thin in details and actually didn't address the real issues of the region. And I'll be very specific on what I mean by that. What the ag proposal failed to do was link their program to water quality objectives, specifically the objectives of beneficial uses. And I think this is key. So I spent the summer walking around, driving around all over the region, trying to get growers to face the fact that really the water quality numeric objectives or narrative standards that protect beneficial uses had to be the central part of the agricultural proposal. So instead of kind of embracing all of the beneficial uses, there are 23 or 24 beneficial uses, I focused the growers on three beneficial uses: protect drinking water, beneficial uses for aquatic habitat, and irrigation protection, so irrigation water protection, which is something that they obviously have a lot more buy-in just in terms of economics. Everything that they had to do had to be focused around the beneficial use protections. And I admit, they're arbitrary. It's a subset of lots of other ones, but it seemed like it was easy to pick those three because those are something you can tell stories around with growers and their range of stringentness. So human protection for drinking water, aquatic habitat, which is generally very restrictive in terms of what can be discharged into water. And a growth out of that was sort of, if you can imagine, sort of the centerpiece of being water quality protection objectives. So water quality, drinking water, aquatic habitat, irrigation water, and then design a program specifically to how do you do that on the ground with farmers. Working with farmers is a lot like herding cats. They're all over the place. They're going very different directions. And it's really hard when you have multiple tenants on the same piece of ground. It makes it very complicated and then very, very creative tenancy, tenant relationships, tenant, landlord, and renter. So the beginning, what I did is kind of create a water program cycle that would begin with a farm plan, farm assessment and action plan. So this is, I would say, a revised version of the quote farm plan, which has been generally updated over the years, but it wasn't auditable. It was a huge document that growers had to fill out, all of their parcels. It took hours and hours. Each parcel had to have a separate farm plan, and in the end, frankly, they were hard to figure out what to do with. And you couldn't come back and actually audit the darn things because there was no like checklist that you can go down and actually see if they've actually done anything on the ground because it was all over the place and too hard, too disorganized. So a farm plan, farm assessment and action plan, which is not a checklist, and I'll be very clear about this. The way I've framed it around with the growers is this is not a checklist of best management practices. We've seen that all over the country. We've seen that in the first ag order, and it's not clear how effective that is. It has to be based on, do you have management practices that are improving water quality on the ground today? And if not today, when will it be there? And what evidence can you show that the water quality is actually improving? So this is meant to be a farm assessment plan where they are, on some level, taking some sort of time to evaluate their practices to make sure they are improving water quality. The next portion of this is a third-party audit. Thankfully, there was no debate on the issue of third party. Growers, hands down, believe that to have a legitimate system, the audit system had to be third party. So a third party audit required that, one, you have trained people that knew what auditing was, which is actually a big issue in food safety and other areas when you don't have good auditors. And CSUMB was ready to train auditors. Other issue was originally the farm, the ag proposal had only one grower field audited, and I said, forget that. There's no way that you can justify a system where the grower gets to pick or someone gets to pick one farm to be audited. All the farms have to be audited. So 20% of the growers each year, so that we don't have to audit everybody every year. This is purely an economic decision on my part. 20% of the growers would be audited for each year, and based on that 20%, all the parcels of that grower would be audited. So the idea is that, is there something I need to know, Francis? Okay. I'm sure I'm supposed to be on some other slide here, but. No, it doesn't matter. The slides have you've all seen these slides, so it doesn't matter. So the 20% audits are then used to rank the growers in terms of priorities, and this is actually my favorite part. The growers of the top 10% of the high risk farms would then be evaluated with what I'm calling a practice effectiveness evaluation program. So we would, it's a lot like what we've done with the proposition monies that we've had, or the 319H money, which is EPA money, to funds implementation of best management practices in this region. It would be privately funded, so we wouldn't be relying on public monies. Through the ag, through the farmers, a part of this coalition, that they would then work together to prioritize farms of the highest potential for contaminating either surface water or groundwaters, and then we would research or test various management practices to improve water quality. So this allows growers to engage in a, frankly, a safe place to try different practices that may not be prescriptive in terms of what the current staff recommendation is, but instead focus on what might be most efficient and most effective in terms of improving water quality. In general, and I will have to say this regardless of my political bent, capital and businesses tend to be very good at innovation. And getting in the way of innovation, I think, is very problematic. So that's why I really like this. And I already have three or four potential pilot projects that growers, industry, input sort of consultants, auditor, all want to start these pilot projects to basically demonstrate that this project could work, which I think is kind of exciting. The reason I haven't gone forward with it is because I wasn't sure how much buy-in I would get from the board and the staff, so I've been trying to hold their jets a little bit. But whenever I work with farmers, when I say, you know, this would be something that we could do, and they say, okay, let's do it tomorrow, and usually I have to say, I'm not ready yet. So, okay, so that kind of...
question for you.
Please.
Is there anything that would prevent this approach with the current proposed order in terms of, you know, the monitoring report?
Yeah, I understand.
There's
a fair amount of confusion on my part, I admit. Okay. It's hard for me to wade through the documents and figure it all out. There is a section that talks about cooperative monitoring, cooperative programs that you can start within the ag order. What is not clear to me, and Whether or not that means you don't have to do any of the tier two, three, one, two, or three reporting requirements. The other issue is, and I assume Lisa can answer this, and maybe can we are we allowed to ask Lisa to answer that?
Sure. I mean, if you're finished with
There's a couple other things.
Okay.
So what I found is that growers that are tier one or tier two have no incentive to work in a cooperative fashion. So here's this is part that I really didn't really get until recently. Some of the and this is also comes from some on the farm monitoring that I've done. I found that the sources of pollution that maybe the board has better data than I do. No correlation to farm size, and no correlation to what chemicals they're putting on the ground. I don't know why. Maybe I'm just a crappy sampler. To be able to do a cooperative program, you need to get everybody in the watershed on the same page. And there's no incentive for a tier one to work with tier two or tier three because they're done. They're out of the program. So they don't have to be. Now, they can out of the goodness of their heart participate in this, but there's a certain disincentive for the tiering system to sort of not let people work together.
Okay. Just so I'm clear that I heard you clearly, what was that about? You didn't find a correlation to something?
With size and what people put on the ground in terms of chemicals.
In terms of
the
causation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
In terms of what people put on the ground, you mean chemicals
inputs,
or nutrients?
Yes, sorry.
Do you mean the application of fertilizers? You have not found any correlation to elevated nutrient levels in receiving waters?
I have found that there's so many other factors that define and contribute to the transport and fate of those chemicals that application rates is not a good predictor.
Okay, but how about as a source?
Well, once you have the source, you know it can go somewhere. And, well, let me put it differently. Because it's a source, it has to come from, let me start with receiving water. If there's a receiving water, it has to come from a source. So the easy answer is that it probably came from someone that's applying the stuff. If you're not applying the stuff, you're definitely not a source.
Oh, okay.
Maybe
that
is it that way.
Your issue is more the walking around with application rates doesn't solve the problem the way it's being proposed, but you're not disputing
the fact. Yeah, I think it's a little more sophisticated than that because it looks at the hazard index looks at a few more parameters than just application rates.
Okay.
But what I am saying is that there are things even besides that that are much more complicated. For example, soil nitrogen cycling is generally, in terms of microbial processes, influenced by carbon to nitrogen ratios and soil temperatures, which can change fairly rapidly in ways that are a little surprising. So, for example, during a cover crop that you've just incorporated, you may all of a sudden have all of your nitrogen tied up and you don't have any nitrogen. So you have to apply some or your crop's not going to go anywhere. Maybe a month later, the soils warm up and all of a sudden all that nitrogen is released and you've got way too much, but it's not like you've added anything. Or the harder one is rainfall, right? If you just put it on and then you get a storm a month later,
right.
Might be leached or something. Is that
yes.
Okay.
Should we have Angela answer your question?
Sure.
It was my question, but he had a question, some confusion about tier one and two.
No, it was on the cooperative program. Mm. If growers elect to be in a coalition or a cooperative program, what is their monitoring requirements? Do they still need to fulfill the tier two and tier three monitoring requirements?
So the short answer to your question is the approach that Dr. Los Huertos is describing is allowable underneath the current order and the proposed order. In terms of the monitoring and reporting, the growers who participate in such an effort can also propose alternative monitoring and reporting for approval and acceptance by the executive officer.
So, in general, I would have been totally fine with that. The problem that I struggled with, and I do not spend a lot of time on this stuff, is that the staff response in July, maybe? Was it July? Was really critical of the ag proposal and didn't seem to create room for the ag alternative. So I was stuck feeling like something's wrong here. Mm. We haven't done enough. And it doesn't sound like the ag proposal is even going anywhere because the staff response was extremely critical of it. So I felt like even though the ag proposal was proposed, apparently that paragraph didn't allow for the room of what ag was proposing, so that that told me we need to put way more detail into this thing to figure out what is possible to fit in with that coalition approach. Is that helping?
Yes.
Excuse me. Yes. Now, maybe I've got it wrong here because I'm really have been spending 3 or 4 hours a day trying to get my head around this stuff. But I think that a difference between the draft orders approach to monitoring and the ag alternative approach to monitoring centers around reportability of individual farm monitoring results. And I think that the draft order approach essentially at this point says you have to be able to say this is the results that came from this individual farm, and that the ag alternative approach was looking at some sort of cooperative monitoring that gave results. I'm not quite sure how sub-watershed a level they gave the results at, but where the results were not necessarily tied to individual farms. Is that, maybe you can clarify, because it seems like there's some confusion as to what's the difference on monitoring.
Right. Let me just be really clear before we get down, I think, a confusing path. So we're only talking about one aspect of the ag proposal here. Mm-hmm. So just to make that really clear, there's other issues that we have commented on. And the fundamental difference, I think, with what Mark is describing and maybe the ag proposal or our interpretation of it being applied in the draft order is that it's for what we anticipate is groups of growers who want to participate in such an effort would come to us and present a case. It's not a full sale. All growers get to participate in this alternative without some justification for what it is the group's doing. And so I don't want to get confused, Mr. Johnson, about the differences, because it's a scaling issue. Does that make sense?
I think. So what you're saying is, as far as if a group of growers wanted to do cooperative testing and wanted to report the results for their sub-watershed as opposed to for individual farms, then it would be an executive director decision whether that was acceptable or not?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay.
Or 10 or 20 or whatever it is.
Mr. Mayor.
Yes. Is it fair to say, Mark, that the ag proposal has less public reporting of results sampled than what is currently in the ag waiver order?
Yes. My guess is that to get an approved coalition approach would require a fair amount of reporting and a quality assurance and project plan and things like that. And I think the ag proposal is saying exactly what Angela described here, if I'm not misunderstanding it. It is a scale thing. This is, we're trying to create an option for lots of growers to become part of a coalition that don't have to come individually as groups or small groups or as watershed groups to develop a alternative approach. And in that, an alternative reporting structure, i.e., reporting, and I was going to get to this in a minute, but reporting within sort of an aggregate reporting structure so that individual growers aren't reporting their on-the-farm or edge-of-field results. Is that answering your question?
To the water board.
Yeah, correct. Yeah.
Okay. Does that answer your question?
Good enough for now.
Good enough for now. Okay. We're going to restart your clock.
Okay,
it's at 23
go.
Minutes.
Okay.
It's been frozen there for about 10. Here we go.
So the next step of the on-farm practice evaluation program is that that would be a two-year project, intensive project, where we'd spend a fair amount of resources to test and evaluate best management practices or practices that have never been tried. Best is a little funny word that way. And that would then feed into the program to change or alter the farm assessment and audit program. So the growers, there are two ways of doing audits. You can use an audit and keep it consistent over time to see how people are improving over time, or you can have an audit actually changes over time with best available information. The growers felt very strongly that they wanted their audit system to reflect the best available information on how to improve water quality. So the audit system would then be the practice effectiveness program would then feed back to the audit system and the farm assessment system to be able to improve what it is that are the typical practices or how they're applied on the ground to be able to improve water quality. Okay, I think I got through that. One of these slides.
Before you go on, have you any analysis of the cost of doing something like that?
Yeah, I think I have that. Oops.
And who would audit this?
Audit, you know, a financial audit? I'm not
well,
sure.
Not so much the financial audit, but who would, because you mentioned auditing the plan or the program.
Yeah.
Who would be the auditor?
So there are waiting in the wings, lots of
people
private
like
industry, no, mostly Primus and other private companies that are very interested in audits. One in particular is very interested in incorporating a water quality as a sustainability audit, and we're actually moving forward with a pilot project to look at their sustainability index and see if we can use it as a performance measure of water quality for the Central Coast. And they have I don't need to go into more detail on that.
Do they have qualified people to do that?
This is a big issue. There are two other components. There are probably more, but two I'm going to think of right now. Technical advisory committee and a public advisory committee that were outlined in the ag proposal. The technical advisory committee would take it upon itself to do a few things. One is train auditors and develop the auditing criteria to make sure that people are not only properly trained, but there's consistency across auditing programs and auditors. It turns out to be a fairly standard issue in auditing that you have to have good, consistent training and high quality people. It's interesting, and I misstated this a couple months ago or a year ago, that one of the options is to have CCAs or crop control advisors, whatever they're called, and pesticide control advisors to help helping with water quality. Generally, they're not qualified to do this. They know parts and bits of water quality, but they don't know the robust areas and needs that would be required for an auditing program. So we will be having to develop a fairly sophisticated auditing program over very short term. And I think one of the staff comments was that they didn't believe a program like this could be implemented rapidly enough. Frankly, I've actually seen how quickly the growers and the private industry has been willing to jump on board and get something going. So I think it's possible, but that has been a concern in almost every grower meeting. How are we going to train these auditors, and what level of standard are we going to make sure that they're meeting?
Well, I think credibility is the important thing.
So let me step back to the other committee. The public advisory committee would be made up of something similar. Growers were suggested that something similar to the regional board, that we would select representatives and have seats that would run across society so that we would have a good representation, and that public advisory committee would be intimately involved in evaluating the audit process and the farm assessment to make sure that there is not only scrutiny from a public standpoint, but also provide that sort of outsider perspective to make sure that there is legitimacy in that. Is that answering the question?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Would the audits be provided to the board, or the summary reports?
So the idea would be that we would be providing a summary report of the audit results. I don't think it would serve either the staff or the board to get flooded with a lot of audit, all the audit details. But I think it's very similar to Water Quality Preservation, Inc., which has done outstanding job summarizing the water quality data over the years. You can look at the raw data, or you can look at their tables and graphs of how of what the toxicity is or the nutrient levels and things like that. And I think that's a very robust and effective tool because it allows the staff and the board to evaluate the effectiveness of the program in a fairly efficient way. So I think the short answer is they would be aggregated reports of the population of audits. In the same way, our practice evaluation program would be an aggregation of the practices and effectiveness in terms of what we often do in our 319H grants is report load reductions. So what percent of load reduction were we able to achieve with this management practice versus another management practice? So very similar in those kinds of frames.
Yeah, I guess my question is, I mean, I really understand the sensitivity of the farmers to having their cultural practices be public information. Farmers are a little competitive with each other. And I also understand the sensitivity of the farmers to having all of the monitoring data be public information on a farm-by-farm basis. At the same time, I really see the need both to have detailed, you know, at a fairly fine geographical level, information for the board on what's actually happening out of this monitoring. Mm. I guess my other concern is if, I mean, there's always going to be a percentage of bad actors who simply aren't really, you know, whether they're paying their $6.74 an acre or whatever or not, aren't doing what they need to do. And it seems like in the ag proposal, essentially they kind of get kicked out at the end, and then the board on enforcement sort of starts from scratch with them. Is that what happens?
Well, that's
a concern.
Yeah, I understand, and I'm not the completely appropriate person to ask, but so I'll take a stab at it. My impression is that the way water quality is enforced is that the board has to start an investigation and then collect data in a very specific way to be able to do an enforcement action. So I don't think it actually sets anything off. What I think it does is actually create a population of growers that are in good standing, that are working really hard, that are moving forward to improve water quality, that the board at least can say they're doing their job. We don't have to worry about them for now. We can work on the population that isn't part of the coalition or has not even filed their NOIs or the other kinds of enforcement issues that the staff have been dealing with in the last few years.
I guess my question is, the grower that is part of the coalition, that does file their paperwork, but that simply isn't changing practices.
It's not going to work. So the whole point of the audit system is that person will not be able to qualify for the program. Because
they would get kicked out of the program at some point?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't make that clear. Yeah.
So that would be some self-policing within the coalition itself.
So I'm going to bore you with one more quote from Brian's paper that I really like. This is evaluating different kinds of policy tools. This is voluntary programs. The success of voluntary environmental agreements relies on three critical traits: a credible enforcement threat from regulators that can fall back if voluntarism fails, i.e., the regional board, a monitoring program preferably implemented by a respected or independent third party, that would be Water Quality Preservation, Inc., and some form of peer sanction for underperformance, preferably carried out by industry insiders, i.e., a coalition with external audit program. So they would be the peer structure that would say you have not met the criteria to be in this program, you are now out of the program. Those names, and the growers have been very honest about this, are glad to throw under the bus. You screwed up. We're submitting your name to the regional board.
Would in this in the proposal, would the folks who got thrown under the bus, as it were, would their audits and monitoring data be provided also to the board?
No, I don't think that would be fair. I don't think we'd be. I don't think we would get the enrollment and trust to. And I want to come back to this because I think this is really important. Do you want to keep going? Okay. To get people to buy into this program and to properly assess what runoff is from a farm, I think we need to create a context where people can look at their water quality data without fear of reprisal. Thank you. I think when I sample my farm and I see that there's a problem, I can do something about it. But if I'm sampling my farm to prevent people from knowing that there's a problem on my farm, we're doing two things. We're not letting the grower learn something about his practices, and we're not allowing the resources to be used to improve those water quality problems. So whenever monitoring is associated with the potential for reprisal, I fear that people will be very selective of how they monitor their farms, and you will not get good data. And I will say, I could probably sample almost any farm in the region and come up with squeaky clean water.
Here's kind of the problem I have with this, just my thoughts, that it's our responsibility to ensure compliance with people, and I don't care which program we are administering. You can replace the word farmer with anything else, auto wrecking yards, wastewater treatment plants. We have to ensure compliance. We have to. And so I struggle with how this really happens when you would be reporting data in the aggregate to us that's camouflaged.
Mm-hmm.
I sense what I'm hearing is really a fear of enforcement with people reporting their water quality data. And I think if that's really what the true fear is, and we should probably discuss that and maybe what we can do with the order that might alleviate that fear somewhat. Well, because I'd rather deal with this more head-on than kind of obliquely and just create another form of paperwork that isn't really going to that may not do what we want and may not even be legal for us to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just throwing that out there as a response to what you're saying, so you could be thinking about
it. Yeah, no, I understand. And maybe Region 5 is not doing it correctly. But I was looking at Region 5 and saying they have apparently a pretty successful coalition approach where they have it's very small, it's cheap, and they don't have the water quality problems we have. I grant that.
Okay.
So there's no doubt that we need something substantially different than Region 5. And the growers understand that. Nevertheless, they do have a program that follows up on growers that are problematic. They do kick them out. And there is no abdication of the regional board's supervision or implementation of the clean water or Quarter Cologne. It's a grower within a coalition got fined several hundred thousand dollars. After appealing, he got it knocked down 10% and still paid several hundred thousand dollars. So I don't think you are releasing the responsibility of compliance. What I think you're doing is creating a context for growers to develop an accountability system where you don't have to be micromanagers. And maybe, I don't know the law well enough, maybe that is not going to be a useful approach legally, but from a purely ivory tower academic perspective, I'm trying to come up with a way of saying, you know, let's all get along. You know, let's see if we can get in a room and figure out a way to make this work. Mm-hmm. Now, if we can't call it, if it's not compliance, maybe we call it something else. I don't know.
Okay.
I want to come back to the fear thing. I think regulators generally do use fear to try to extract behavior changes. I think that's often a very good thing to have in the background, but it's not a good motivator for changing behavior. And I think most of us can think of our own examples of that. So I want to...
Seems to work with my kids at times. Well, I'm not trying to say that ag is kids, but on a basic human level,
I understand.
You know, it can work.
Before you proceed, I want to go back. Mr. Johnson touched lightly on the issue or proprietary information from farmers. How does this coalition able to work around that issue? My next question is that you mentioned auditing 20% each year, 5-year permit, so that's 100%. And is that across all three tiers, or are you saying do away with the tiers and just do take 20% every year?
I'll ask the second one first, because I can't remember the first one.
Proprietary information.
The idea of the I forgot the second one now too. I'm a really good teacher, let me tell you. What was the second one again?
One at a time, Russ.
Yeah, please.
One question at a time.
Well, the first question I had was, you're not as old as I am. I'm the one.
No, but his mind is thinking three times as fast as ours is.
I know he is.
Yeah.
A typical professor teaching is looking ahead.
You wanted
but
to
my question,
address.
My first question was, how does the coalition handle proprietary information? That's always been an issue that's been brought up on almost every workshop and hearing that we've had that I've been involved in the last 15, 16 years with ag waivers.
Yeah, that's actually a really good question. So the growers, a part of the coalition, would be participating in a way that would promote collaboration with their practices to improve water quality. The capacity to do that within this group would be that they would be, let's say, forced, encouraged, willing to trust that that this is going to be a program that is going to be evaluating their practices in a way on terms of performance and not necessarily secrets of how they're getting there. So what we're doing is really measuring performance on the farm, not necessarily talking about what kind of catalytic converter you have.
So the end results is really what you're looking for. It doesn't matter how they get there.
Yeah.
And what a proprietary information they use or secrets that they have to end up with the results is all we count. Okay. The other question I had was that you brought up about auditing 20%.
Oh, yeah.
And my question was, is taking 20% of each tier or taking 20% of the
way and that convinced that I would have put in proposal attachment B the way it was put in. But the way that I am talking about this today is this would be a voluntary program that anybody in any tier could join in, and within that tiering system that they would be a part of this program as a voluntary program. The way I've characterized this is an alternative to the tiering, but a voluntary choice to leave the tiering system. And part of it is because many growers have actually parcels that are in all three tiers, and it gets extremely complicated to try to manage those systems. And here's a way that they could actually manage all their parcels within one program to not try to keep track of what tier. And frankly, depending on what your crop is during that, if you're a farm field, depending on what that crop is at any given time, it might be falling into a different tier at different months of the year, which I actually don't know how you would do that.
I know that issue was brought up before on the acreage, and that seemed to be very cumbersome on how to handle that. And
Yeah, and it doesn't get easier in my program on some level. So, full disclosure, there are still tenancy issues where a farm that is doing best management practice for strawberries might not be the best management practice for leafy greens. Yet they're both leasing the same parcel and both part of the cooperative program. So there is a bit of a learning curve. The nice thing is that the growers are there at the table collaboratively trying to solve this problem instead of jockeying and arguing each other about who's in what tier. And I like that approach. Well, it also doesn't, the staff don't have to sort of try to figure out who's in what tier all the time.
I think it makes a difference, too, in the best management practices. I don't want to pick on strawberries or leafy greens, but if you do it in west of Salinas, you have different soils than compared to the east side, so those practices in the Blanco area may not work in the east side.
Yeah, I can guarantee they won't.
And so, consequently, there's an issue there how each practice, I mean, you can't have just one practice for strawberries, one for leafy greens, because the soils make all the other difference in the whole issue.
Okay, they have 20 minutes left, so I have the clock stopped, so why don't we'll let them now go ahead.
Yeah, and
that's okay.
And I took your advice, and I'm trying to keep this short.
Well, I'm sorry I interrupted you,
but this is the first presentation we've got, and there's more, and I'm looking at what time we're going to be out of here, and it's going to be late.
I got a note from the executive officer that they've extended this to 8 a.m. Is that...
That's what the sling bags are for. Okay.
So the
question did come up about costs.
Yeah.
So
right.
This was the early, this is the information already presented on top. The bottom I'm not presenting because that's not new. That's not allowed. So I'm going to take that away because I'm not supposed to show that. I forgot that slide got on there. So the costs are substantially lower than what we estimate, what Brad Barbeau and Kay Mercer estimate. I was in the room when they presented it, so I'm not sure why I said we. Their interviewees were biased. They picked Tier 3 growers. Of the Tier 3 growers, they found that some actually had parcels that were Tier 1, some were Tier 2, Tier 3, and they estimated the cost between, I really don't remember the numbers, $4 to $100 an acre, $23 to $230, and $70 to $620. I used sort of estimates of how many people might be able to participate in this program if we had a target population of somewhere between 50% to 80%. It'd be around $7 to $12 an acre, so substantially less. Nevertheless, I will say that they didn't throw rocks at me. There were generally strong indignation to disappointment to, oh, my God, that's a lot of money. My boss is never going to buy into this program. So it's not a trivial amount of money. And $12 an acre may sound very small, but it adds up pretty quickly when you've got a couple thousand acres and the margins on some of these crops, you know, you lose money 4 out of 5 years. So that can be pretty substantial. The only really last thing I wanted to bring up was sort of the recommendations on here that actually I don't really believe. It asks for, basically a 6-month period to work through harmonizing this approach with the staff approach. I don't think we need 6 months. I think we can do it in a couple months. I do have a full-time job, so I would be less than excited about doing it if the board was not interested in seeing this approach fleshed out more. There are a lot of participants and stakeholders that are very interested in seeing this proposal go forward. There's also a lot of capacity, I think, in the region to jump on board with this process. I would say that the growers are highly motivated right now. They seem to get the point that they don't want to pay up to $1,000 an acre to in Tier 3 $800, I don't remember the number actually, but whatever it was. The higher number of acres that might be required to fulfill the staff requirements. So I think there's an opportunity right now that the growers would be very interested in coming to the table and working out some of the details of this with some indication that this might be a program that the board felt like supportive of. And I think that's all I wanted to say.
Okay. Dr. Hunter?
Looking at the list there, one of them, second from the bottom, alternative to individual groundwater monitoring, which hasn't been touched on yet. Yeah. And that one, to me, is a really important one.
I skipped a bunch of slides there. So yeah. Do you want me to go back to that?
Yeah, can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, let's talk. The groundwater is huge. So this original proposal talked about assessing the status of groundwater quality, associated beneficial uses, provide feedback to growers or areas of concern, establish a cooperative monitoring program. This was meant to, again, alleviate some of the issues of having data turned over to the regional board. Dischargers will elect to participate in a similar surface water, but a groundwater cooperative monitoring program. I skipped over these slides in part because of the XBX 21 state project, state legislative activities there, and I was a little frightened to get into too much details on this when I don't know what the outcome is that's going to be. But let me at least say that the growers were very interested in coming up with a cooperative monitoring program for groundwater. They this is my take on groundwater. I felt like, and I'm going to ruin the reputation of the Superfund program by talking about it this way, but on some level, the Superfund's program is meant to clean up groundwater by holding companies liable, no matter how far away they were from the actual dumping of solvents or whatever it is in the groundwater. That has led to a host of bankruptcies and people basically coming up with holding companies so they could go bankrupt, and no one can clean up these stupid toxic sites. Santa Clara is the highest concentration of Superfund sites in the world, and we don't know what to do with them because we're waiting for federal money to clean them up, and the feds are broke. So I thought, that maybe not is a great idea, to hold liable growers that may not have contributed to the groundwater issue. We potentially could follow that same little trail of bankruptcies, holding companies, people disappearing, don't know who to hold liable to it, and it would never really solve the problem. So I framed it around growers really need to come up with what the only thing they could control right now is a really outstanding best management program to reduce, in this case, nitrate leaching to groundwater. So that fit in with the program evaluation program that I described, that best management practices and priorities would be set about leaching. So similar kinds of things of using the hazard index to identify regions with high nitrate leaching, using farm audits to identify farms that have the high potential contaminating groundwater, prioritizing areas that have vulnerabilities to groundwater contamination and or communities that are using those drinking water standards. I'm going to go off script here. I had spent a fair amount of the summer promoting an idea of developing a grower early warning kind of process where the growers would share their data within sub-basins to look at where the nitrate contamination is. So even though they may not be submitting that data to the regional board per se, they would be working in sub-communities or some sort of cooperative to be able to identify, saying, hey, you know what, we think there is a potential problem of contaminating a groundwater source for some communities around our area, and we want to develop some strategies to deal with that. And we approached the Monterey Water Resources Agency about developing a program for shallow groundwater monitoring to do exactly that. Because of the XBX stuff, I didn't really know where to go with that, and so I was a little hesitant to flesh those details out more at this point. But frankly, I can't think of anything more complicated to try to address in this ag order to deal with both the groundwater, existing groundwater supply, and the potential for continued groundwater contamination. So I tried to limit it just to the potential for current leaching and try to get into the sort of, I want to call legacy groundwater contamination, but it's not exactly the right word. Is that?
Well, one of the things that I think we get out of the draft order is a much clearer picture than currently exists of the state of the groundwater on a sub-basin by sub-basin level. And while I understand that just because the groundwater under a particular farmer's ground has high nitrates doesn't necessarily mean those nitrates could have come from five farms over. I get that. But is there a provision in the plan you've been working on to provide to the board at least on a fairly fine geographic level, if not on a farm-by-farm base, on some sort of a fine enough level that it's useful to get that picture of results of groundwater monitoring? I mean, I understand the individual well concern.
Yeah, I'm going to punt on that, not because I don't think it's an important issue, but on some level, I don't know if that's a landowner issue versus a grower issue. And I've been focusing with growers on practices where it's almost the liability of the landowner and the onus on the landowner to kind of deal with those issues. And I will say the growers in the region have a hugely diverse relationship with their landowners, and it varies by county and region in particularities. It also varies dramatically by individuals, and some landowners are really engaged. Some live in Fiji, and so this is a really hard thing for me to figure out how to deal with. And frankly, I'm hoping the state will pick this ball up and move it forward better. I have not gone to that level of detail, the sub-basin, in terms of identifying groundwater issues, because I'm really trying to stay on the practices level and the surface vadose root zone area as a let's make sure we're not continuing the problem.
So in terms of the alternative, the groundwater monitoring sites are sort of an open question at this point?
Yes, and I would say the growers are extremely interested in listening to alternatives, a way of dealing with it. And I have been, I floated a few, but I didn't feel like I had the capacity to go too far and too fast on some level, because I wasn't even sure the board would even buy what I've already started. So I don't think I pursued all the possibilities as much as I might have.
Are people generally aware staff is not proposing that anybody put in a new well? I mean, is that based on your
discussion? Yeah, I think so.
You understand that?
Yeah, I think it
was. No one's being asked to go drill a water well.
No. I think the issue, from what I understand, is the reporting seems to assume some sort of cause and effect. And I think there's some fears around that.
Okay.
And I think the other issue is...
So that's the enforcement thing
I think
identified
so. Yep.
earlier,
yep.
The fear of
yep.
data.
Yeah, and then I think the other key part of this is... Oh, darn.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah, to try to answer...
Where'd he go?
Oh, there he is. Mr. Johnson's question completely disappeared from my view. Our reading of the ag proposal is that the groundwater monitoring is completely voluntary. So in terms of asking about how fine-grained it would be up to the growers to volunteer to sample.
That's not how I framed it, but it may have been written that
way.
I'm
talking about the ag alternative.
Yeah, that's not how I framed it with my details.